Hello, welcome to yet another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm the host, William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe to this podcast through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page and or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk to stay updated with the latest episodes. There's also my website, armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, where I post show notes and other interesting links. Remember, if you enjoy or benefit in some way from this podcast and you want to support it and me, you can do so directly via my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and you can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. Also, let me flag up again the special deal available to Turkey Book Talk listeners. You can now get a handsome 33% discount plus free delivery on 4 excellent books published by Hearst Publishers. All the books on the list, available at cut price, are written by authors who have featured on this podcast. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poison Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, and Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter. To order any of those titles in hardback for a third off the original price, follow the link that I post on armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, which will take you to the special page for the deal. I've also put that link in the show notes of this episode on iTunes, Podbean, etc. So yes, check that out. But enough waffle, let's get on with this latest episode. In it, I speak to Cuma Çiçek. He's an academic and writer, and previously worked for a number of years as an advisor in the Diyarbakır Metropolitan Municipality. He's also the author of a new book, The Kurds of Turkey, National, Religious and Economic Identities, which is published by IB Taurus. At the moment, of course, the Kurdish movement in Turkey is under enormous pressure after the collapse of the peace process in summer 2015. Many MPs for the People's Democratic Party, or HDP, have been thrown in jail, and elected local administrations have been replaced by appointees from Ankara. News reports often talk about the Kurds as a homogeneous whole, whether in Turkey, Syria, Iraq, or Iran. But that's actually very misleading. The reality is richer and far more nuanced. Like all national groups, Kurds everywhere are riven by various divides, interests, and shades of opinion. The Kurds of Turkey digs in to explore these divides, particularly focusing on divergent economic interests and disagreements over religion and secularism. I started by asking Cuma Çiçek to outline these divides and how his research explored them.
When I analyze the Kurdish collective action, I mean the main conflicts, the negotiation and dialogue between and among the Kurdish groups, I saw that there were many different groups, and I classified these groups into three basic blocks, and I named them as the national bloc, the Kurdish national bloc, the Kurdish religious bloc that contains two different groups, I mean the Alevi Kurds and the Sunni Muslim Kurds, and finally the Kurdish economic elites bloc. When I say the Kurdish national group, mainly I refer the groups who frames the Kurdish issue as a national issue or as a national liberation issue, who has a left-wing heritage, and who are also the secular groups. And I mean, the when we look at these national groups, the today the HDP and the DBP, I mean the People's Democratic Party and Democratic Regions Party constitutes the principal or the leading national groups, but also there are several other groups like Freedom and Socialism Party, like HAKPAR, the Party for the Rights and Freedom, like KADEP, the Participatory Democracy Party. So there was not just the leading Kurdish movement, but there were also other national groups which also framed the Kurdish issue as a national liberation issue with a secular and left-wing perspective. But also there were some groups, I mean, who had a position in the political sphere in accordance with their religious identity. I mean the Sunni Muslim identity and the Alevi identity. And there were also some economic elites which are, in fact, it's also a bloc. I mean, it's not a homogeneous group, but a heterogeneous group which contains several different groups But basically, they are also mostly secular, and they mostly concentrate on the socio-political aspect of the Kurdish issue. And they have a good relation with the central state because of the Kurdish region's dependent economy. So basically, the research was focusing on these divisions and the conflict, the negotiation, or the dialogue based on this division in the Kurdish society. Today, in fact, when we look at the Kurdish political sphere, we can see that there are new actors. I mean, in the national bloc, in the time that I carry out the research, there were AK Parti, KADEP, and ÖSP, and TDSK. But today we know that there are, I think, six political parties that we can frame as the national group. They mostly have a left-wing heritage, and most of them are secular. So we can say that today also there is a big national bloc which contains several different parties alongside the Kurdish, the leading Kurdish movement. I mean the HDP and the DBP, Democratic Regions Party.
I wonder, would you say that divide between the kind of secular left-wing nature of the main Kurdish nationalist movement somehow limit its appeal? Because often, you know, one of the main lines of attack really by the government, the AKP, is that they always talk about the HDP today as being, you know, atheist or Zoroastrian and not having the kind of same religious Muslim sensibilities as many people in the society.
In fact, when we look at the historical background of the leading Kurdish movement, I mean the HDP and DBP and also the PKK, we can say that this movement cannot be reduced a national movement. It's also a left-wing political movement. I mean, in the 1980s, it was basically a socialist movement. I mean, the socialist idea was one of the main motivation of the most of the political activists in this movement. And when we look at this heritage, this movement is highly a secular movement. I mean, until the 1990s, the relationship between the leading Kurdish movement and the Sunni Muslim groups and political groups was very limited. And the religion issue was just an obstacle on the way of the Kurdish national liberalization for the Kurdish movement. But we know that after the 1990s, the leading Kurdish movement has started to revise this social imaginary, and they tried to build an alternative Islam. I mean, I can remember that in 1990s, the Öcalan was talking about revolutionary Islam. So they tried to build some alternative Sunni Muslim or Islamist organizations like the Kurdistan Islamic Union, like the Alevi Union, like the Yazidi Union. But in this time, I mean, in 1990s, the religion issue was just an instrument to enlarge the socio-political mobilization for the Kurdish national liberalization. But I think after the 2002, I mean, after the AKP rule, the leading Kurdish movement faced a real challenge, a pro-Islamist and liberal AKP. The leading Kurdish movement tried to revise its, I mean, position about the religion. When we look at the current situation, I can say that there has been a remarkable revision or mobilization about Islam or about the framing Islam in a different perspective. Maybe we can talk about the HDP also, you know, for instance. In fact, HDP was also a part of this project. I mean, the project of building a multilateral, multi-actor-based, you know, organization, which was containing also the Islam or the Sunni Muslim mobilization. But at the end, I think the relationship between the leading Kurdish movement and Islam is today also problematic. They are trying to revise their position about the religion, but I don't think so that they passed the instrumentalist and sporadic perspective about the religion. So the conflict between Islam and the left-wing, the Kurdish political, I mean, mobilization, is still ongoing, I think.
Another very crucial division is this split, as we say there, between the very traditional kind of left-wing stance of the national movement and what you describe in the book as the economic elite, the Kurdish economic elite. Could you just give a bit of detail about that? You know, what are the tensions involved in this relationship?
You know, we have been facing the emergence of the Kurdish economic elites for last 2 decades at least. But when we look at the Kurdish region or the economy of the Kurdish region, we can say that the Kurdish region is the most underdeveloped region in the Turkey. And this situation, I mean, provoked two important results. The first, I think, after the 1980s, the most of the Kurdish national movement were left-wing political movement. I mean, the socio-economic condition of the Kurdish region made a very useful, I mean, socio-political condition for the left-wing movement. And when we look at the leading Kurdish movement and the other national movement, we can say that all of them are left-wing political movement. So, I mean, the basic social base of the Kurdish opposition is, the low and the middle class in the Kurdish society. But on the other hand, when we look at the Kurdish economic elites, and they are mostly very weak actors because of the Kurdish region's weak socioeconomic conditions. And in the Kurdish region, we know that the state-based economy, I mean, and the economy based, the municipality based, the governorship based, the central state, I mean, the ministries, has a very big part in the Kurdish economy. So, I mean, for the Kurdish economic elite, if you want to become an actor, if you want to, I mean, increase your financial or institutional capacity, you need to have a good relationship with the government. And secondly, I think there is a remarkable division at the normative level. I mean, when we look at the Kurdish political movement, and they are mostly, I mean, left-wing, but when we look at the Kurdish economic elite, they have a liberal perspective. I mean, they try to integrate the Kurdish economy to the global, I mean, liberal market. So, I mean, there is a remarkable division at normative level. And this division at normative level between the Kurdish political movement and the Kurdish economic elite pave also remarkable obstacle at the level of, I mean, interests and ideas. When you ask the main aspect of the Kurdish issue, they underline different aspects of the Kurdish issue. I mean, for the Kurdish movement, the identity issue is the most important part of the issue. But when you try to speak with the Kurdish economic elites, it's not just an identity issue, but it's also the socio-economic underdevelopment of the Kurdish region. And they try to, I mean, integrate this region to the global economy with the cooperation of the central state. So, I mean, it's not just a normative division, but it's also a division at the interest level.
I also want to talk about the question of tribal influence. The book doesn't address it too much, but it seems to me a kind of crucial determiner of politics in the southeast. In what way are traditional tribal ties still important in the Kurdish region, and what kind of political effect does this have?
You are right. In fact, I did not focus on a tribal issue in this research. Basically, I carried out this research in the urban areas. So you are right. In fact, it's in the research. But I don't think so that the tribal issue is so important, I mean, in the construction process of the Kurdish political sphere. The most of the Kurdish society today live in urban areas. I think it's over the 70% of the population. But the tribal issue is important for several reasons, I think. The first is we can say that one of the social base of the Kurdish pro-Islamism is the tribal-based relationship. I mean, when we look at the historical background of the Kurdish Islamism or different Kurdish Islamist groups, we can say that the Tariqat is one of the main area in which the Kurdish pro-Islamist political groups organized. So it's important, I mean, for the Kurdish pro-Islamism, and it's today also a social base for this kind of socio-political mobilization. And the second issue is, I think, about the security issue, because you know that in the rural area, There is still an ongoing conflict between the PKK and the central state, and we know that in the rural areas, the tribal relations is very important in the constructing process of the relationship or conflict between the PKK and the central state. I mean the Korucular and the village guardians. We cannot talk about the issue of the village guardians without taking into consideration the tribal issue.
And the village guard, just to explain, like the village guards were basically employed by the state.
I mean, in Turkey, we talk about the 10,000, the armed militants of PKK, but there are also over the 60,000, the village guarders, I mean, korucular. So it's very important, I mean, in the terms of the security and in terms of the ongoing conflict in the rural areas. And as I said, it's also important for the Kurdish pro-Islamism, because we know that the Tariqat is a principal social base of the Kurdish pro-Islamism, and the Tariqat mostly organized in the rural areas, I mean, among the tribals. But as I said today, I don't think so. There is a remarkable influence of the tribal relations on the Kurdish society, because we know that the Kurdish politics has became mostly even urbanized, and the when we look at the demography of the Kurdish society, the most of the Kurdish population today live in the urban areas. I mean, in the metropolitan cities like Diyarbakir, like Mardin, like Van. So maybe that was because of that I did not add this aspect into the research.
Now, obviously, notoriously, Kurdish politics is this very intimidating acronym soup of organizations and parties over the years. And today, of course, we have the People's Democratic Party, which is the national. It's the Kurdish party that's represented across Turkey, and it gained support initially a few years ago by trying to appeal also to Turkish leftists, so kind of transcending the Kurdish limit, having this Kurdish nationalist base, but also kind of reaching across the lines. But of course, after the end of the peace process in summer 2015, that process came to an abrupt halt, and now the HDP and the regional party in the southeast is under immense pressure and being removed from local administrations, and the two leaders, Selahattin Demirtas and Figen Yüksekdağ, are in jail. Could you just talk about that process, how it tried to expand its coalition, and what kind of situation it's in now, how it has come to be under this enormous pressure that we see today?
I define, the HDP project as a two parallel processes. I mean, the most people think that the HDP is a left-wing project. I mean, the most Kurdish nationalists think like that. And they think that this is a project against, the Kurdish national liberation, sociopolitical mobilization. But I don't think so, that this is the reality. I think the HDP was two parallel processes. At one hand, the leading Kurdish movement tried to build the Kurdistanization process. In Turkey, we say the Kurdistanileşme. I mean, they tried to build an autonomous, political sphere in the Kurdish region. But at the same time, they tried to build a national sociopolitical, left-wing movement, including the Kurds, the socialists, the feminists, and the democratic Sunni Muslims. So I don't think so that the HDP was just a left-wing project, but it was also an autonomization process of the Kurdish area. I, in an article, I conceptualized this process as Türkiyeleşme ve Kürdistanileşme, Turkification and Kurdistanization. So I think these two processes were two main objectives of the leading Kurdish movement. And I think so. I think that when we look at the last legislative election, the HDP achieved, two aims together. At the national level, they passed the electoral threshold and they took 13% of the vote. And in the Kurdish region, the HDP was the first party, in the 12 provinces, and in the 11 provinces, it was the hegemonic power. And there were over the 15% between the HDP and its opposition. So, I mean, it enlarged and deepened its hegemony in the Kurdish region, and it became, a remarkable opposition movement at the national level. So, both at the Turkification process and the Kurdistanization process, I think the HDP was very successful. So I don't think so that these two processes are against each other. Now, it's the first thing. And the second thing that I must is the fact that, in the Kurdish region, I think the autonomization process of the Kurdish region, increased or has been increasing, for the last decades. Alongside the leading Kurdish movement in the Kurdish pro-Islamist group, there is an increase of the Kurdish sense, the sense of the Kurdistanization process. And I think there is a process of a second Kurdish social imaginary in the Kurdish region. A pro-Islamist, a conservative, Kurdishness is ongoing in the Kurdish region. Today, when you talk with the AKP's supporter Kurds, the Kurds who support the AKP, who work in the AKP, they also talk about, the Kurdish self-government. They also talk about the Kurdish identity, the Kurdish education or the rise in the mother tongue. So when we look at the situation alongside the HDP, there is a second, the emergence of the Kurdishness in the Kurdish region. So I think this process, supports the autonomization process of the Kurdish political sphere in Turkey. And alongside this process, we must also note the transborder, the dynamics or the transborders, transformation in the geopolitical issue of the Kurdistan. In the Syria and in Iraq, there is a process of not state building, but we can say a process of a de facto, the Kurdish self-rule in both countries. And this process influenced directly, the old Kurdish political groups, not just the HDP or DBP, Democratic Regions Party, but also the Kurds who support the AKP, but also the Hudapar, the pro-Islamist Kurdish Legal Party. So we can say that, the geopolitical dynamics, the new transformation of the Kurdish pro-Islamism and the current situation of the state of emergency, all of these dynamics, increase the process of autonomization in the Kurdish region. Now, we know that there is a big political crisis in Turkey today, in the Kurdish region in particular. The Kayyum or the bureaucrats that appointed in place of the mayors, the jailed MPs. But when we look at, the street, the ordinary peoples, their emotion or their political ideas about the Kurdistan issue, about the Kurdish issue, is increasing. The current state of emergency does not decrease, the Kurdish socio-political mobilization among the different Kurdish groups, but I think it increased the emotion and the political sensitiveness of the different Kurdish groups about the Kurdish issue, about the Kurdistan issue, about the Syrian Kurdish region, about Iraqi and Kurdish region. So I think the autonomization process of the Kurdish region is ongoing, and maybe after 2 or 5 or 10 years in the future, I think the Turkish will face with a more autonomized, or more autonomous Kurdish region in the terms of the socio-political mobilization, in the terms of the socio-political agenda, and in the terms of the Kurdish socio-political groups.
Also, talking about the current situation, you mentioned the June 2015 election where the HDP crossed the threshold and won over 13% of the votes. And then, of course, in the November 2015 election, the re-election, it kind of fell back. And part of the loss in support was that it was seen that some more kind of conservative Kurdish voters returned to vote again for the AKP, which was crucial in bringing them back to power. Obviously, polls are very unreliable. I'm thinking about the presidential referendum next month on the constitutional changes. Polls are obviously unreliable, but I read somewhere that something like 25% of Kurdish voters are thinking of voting yes on that referendum. What role do you think Kurds will play in the referendum? And particularly, how do you think the the Turkish Nationalist Alliance that has taken place between the government and the MHP, the Nationalist Movement Party, affect the kind of decision-making process among Kurdish voters, particularly in the southeast?
I think the last urban conflict, you know, the decreased the importance of the politics among the Kurdish society. I mean, the most Kurdish society today do not trust, I mean, the politics in general. I mean, in the Kurdish leading movement on the one hand, and the AKP on the other hand. So when you look at the ordinary people, and they have many, I mean, questions about the role of the politics, I mean, in general, and in the solution of the Kurdish issue in particular. Because, you know, the last urban conflict reduced, I mean, the hope and the hope for the politics and the reliability of the politics for the people. You know, the most people believed in the leading Kurdish movement, and they supported the HDP. And the HDP, you know, passed the electoral threshold. But after 1 or 2 weeks, this electoral achievement, you know, the urban conflict was started. So the people asked that why we must, I mean, vote for the referendum. I mean, they don't think so that the politics can play a critical role. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, at the end, over the 500,000 people have been forced to leave their home. Over the 10,000 people lost their life during this urban conflict. And they saw that the AK Party government also has a remarkable role or has a responsibility in this destructive, I mean, process. So the first thing that I must mention, the reliability of the politics or the trust in politics in the Kurdish region is very low. And I think because of that, most people will not participate in the election. And the second thing, you know, over the 500,000 people left their home, and I don't think so they will able to participate in the election, because, I mean, they do not have the legal address, and there is not the basic condition for the participating in the referendum. And the third issue, or the third important issue, is the coalition between the AK Party or the AKP and the Nationalist Movement Party, I mean the MHP or MHP. And in fact, in the Kurdish region, there is the clear negative effect of this coalition on the people. Because, you know, if you want to solve the Kurdish issue in a political manner, you need to pass the traditional, I mean, the discourse, you know, the ideas about the Kurdish issue, which basically frame the issue as an issue of security, as an issue of you know, threatened against the Turkish state and the Kurd Turkish nation. So if you have a good coalition with this nationalist movement, how you will solve the Kurdish issue or the Kurdish conflict? So this affects the people, I mean, and I think this will also influence many people, I mean, to not voting for the AK Party. But, you know, when we look at the current situation, in fact, the AK Party in the region, I mean, the Kurdish supporters of AK Party, there is not a good or there is not, I mean, a visible, you know, the campaign or electoral campaign in the Kurdish region. I think it's because of this normative frame. I mean, the current coalition or the last urban conflict made very difficult for the AK Party supporters, I mean, to organize a campaign in the Kurdish society. And for the leading Kurdish movement, there is also the same situation. I mean, you know, the most people criticize the HDP because of enough things to prevent this urban conflict. And most people do not trust in politics, I mean, in HDP because of the urban conflict. And second, you know, the current institutional capacity of the HDP also is very weak. I mean, because of the emergency of the state, the most parliament, I mean, were in jail. You know, the many municipalities, I mean, they're under the state control. The most political activists are also detained or in jail. Most of them, I mean, they left the country, I mean, to the European countries. And many people, I mean, do not participate in the political, I mean, campaign in the Kurdish region. So when we look at the Kurdish region, in fact, there is not an atmosphere, I mean, for the referendum. So I think And because of that process, because of these processes, the participation in the election, I think will be probably very low. And the AKP, I think, we lost a remarkable, social support in this region. And by also, I think the HDP also was, lost a remarkable vote because of the boycott and because of the interest of the people in the politics in general, but in the Kurdish, the leading Kurdish movement in particular.
That was Cumhur Çiçek. Thank you very much to him. You can read my review of his book, The Kurds of Turkey, at the Hurriyet Daily News. Let me just remind you of that 33% discount plus free delivery that Turkey Book Talk listeners can get on 4 different books from the publisher Hearst. To check out the books available and order using that discount, follow the links that I've posted at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and in the show notes to this episode and on the Turkey Book Talk Facebook page. Also, don't forget to rate or review this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like that Facebook page, or do both, to stay updated with new episodes. Email me with recommendations, feedback or abuse via williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. That's John with a H. And remember, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Özlem Bey Arslan, Steve Bryant, and Aaron Ataman. But until the next episode, thanks again for listening.